dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
This is Rolando de Aguiar with the Philadelphia IMC in Washington, D.C. on Friday, March 22nd. Angels of the Public Interest demonstration in front of the FCC building.
And it must be very cold. I can hear you shivering.
Yeah, I am. It's got a pretty good-sized group out here anyway. A lot of people down from Philadelphia, some from New York, a couple of guys up from Chapel Hill, so East Coast is represented well. The group is, most of the people here are here to protest against media consolidation, the reduction of rules that the FCC has removed some rules regarding media consolidation so that single owners can own large percentages of media outlets within a single market. We got probably 50 to 100 people dressed as angels. This was in response to a comment that FCC Chairman Powell made last year that he waited all night for the angel of the public interest to appear, but she did not come. So today is kind of an effort to have the angel of the public interest and all of her friends show up and show Chairman Powell that there is a public interest that cares about what he does with regard to telecommunications deregulation.
FCC Chair Michael Powell is only the latest of a decades-long line of government officials who have spoken out of both sides of their mouths about government regulation of the broadcast spectrum. The argument they have made is that the free market will provide broadcasting that best serves the public interest by giving the people what they want. At the same time, these government boosters of so-called deregulation have in no way suggested giving up the government's power to decide who gets to use the broadcast spectrum and who doesn't. We're all aware of totalitarian nations with their government media, or of stories of journalists jailed or executed for critical reporting. American censorship takes a softer, more hidden form. Most media is controlled by people who are benefiting from the present government policies. No accident, because as media makers, they have been instrumental in shaping the public consensus. The owners of the press are free to say what they want, but most of us are not free to be owners. As a result of a recent Supreme Court decision lifting the ban enforced by the FCC on one owner dominating the various information streams available to a community, most of us could soon have less access to real information than a resident of Stalin's Russia or Hitler's Germany. This process is already well underway, as we'll hear tonight, even in two areas believed to be havens for diverse ideas: book publishing and public broadcasting. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Michael Moore is a documentary filmmaker and television satirist whose productions include Roger and Me, The Big One, TV Nation, and The Awful Truth. He's also the author of several nonfiction books of social commentary, including his previous bestseller, Downsize This. Moore's newly released book, Stupid White Men, almost didn't make it to the stands, as we'll hear in this talk Moore gave at a recent book signing in Arlington, Virginia.
I've got this book out. It's called Stupid White Men. It's a book that almost didn't come out. I wrote it last summer. 50,000 copies of it were printed on September 10th, and it was supposed to be shipped on the 11th. We know what happened on September 11th, so originally it was supposed to be on sale on October 2nd, and October 2nd came and went, and then November 2nd came and went, then it was getting near December 2nd, and I, I'm asking, where's the book? What's going on? Where's my book? The publisher said, well, we'd like you to go back. You see, the political climate in the country has changed, and so we don't think your book, A, isn't going to do very well now, and B, we think it's wrong to put a book out that criticizes George W. Bush like that. That wasn't the exact word they used. They used the word president, but they... I'm only allowed to use that word with quote marks around it, but we'll get into that in a second. They said, we'd like you to rewrite up to 50% of the book and tone down your dissent. And we think it's intellectually dishonest now for you to have a book out there where you don't at least admit that George W. Bush has done a good job the last few months. And I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I mean, it was just, have you ever been in that place in your life where you just start in a downward spiral and you're caught in some vortex that you never thought you'd be in? You know, everyone's had at least one job like that, right? Where you just can't believe what you're hearing is coming out of the mouth of a human. And then you think the pod people have somehow taken over, or there's some kind of weird science fiction going on here. And I said, well, I'm not gonna rewrite 50% of one word. This is exactly how I feel. And they said, well, but wouldn't you like to update the book? You know, you could write a new chapter. We'll let you write a new chapter. You can update it. And I said, well, what's there to update? You know, things suck before September 11th. They suck after September 11th. I mean, what? What's the... I said, okay, I'll write a new chapter. And the chapter will be called The Sad and Sordid Whereabouts of Bin Cheney and Bim Bush. No, I don't think we would like that chapter. And we'd like you to change the name. The name of the book is no longer good. I said, what happened? All the stupid white men are gone? They suddenly got smart? You know, what's wrong with the name? It's just not right for the political climate of our times. I said, what is this climate word? It's like suddenly everybody's turned into a meteorologist? I mean, it was like, the climate. I said, no, if you want to change the title, here's a title. Bring Me the Head of Antonin Scalia. It's a biblical kind of a, you know, book. But no, we don't like that title. I said, well, what title are you thinking of changing it to? We're thinking of changing it to Michael Moore, the American. I said, wow, that's really heavy. I mean, it's like nobody would ever have guessed I'm an American. I said, no, come on, guys. This is just everybody just calm down and, you know, it'll be okay. Well, it wasn't okay. And they said, no, we're not gonna put this book out. And we're now known as the September 11th publishers. I said, what do you mean by that? Well, we put out a book about the heroes. And we have a book out by the police commissioner of New York. And we're putting out all these special quick books on September 11th. I said, wow. And your book doesn't fit into our new plan. And this is HarperCollins. I said, well, I'm sorry. I can't think of a better book actually to have out right now because I think that we need to be talking about a lot of the stuff that's in this book. Well, finally they said, look, we've had it. We're gonna shred your book. They'd already printed 50,000 copies sitting in this warehouse in Scranton, Pennsylvania. We're gonna shred your book. Actually, the word they used was, we're going to pulp it. We're going to pulp your book. And, you know, and I just thought, I'm just feeling so, like, depressed at this moment. And then, you know, just whatever it is, the Irish in me, you know, whatever that mechanism is that says, drink or laugh. All right, let's try laughing first. You know, but it's kind of like you look for the silver lining in every cloud, right? And I thought, you know what? This really is a good thing in a way. It kind of shows how far we've come as a society and how much better things are that those who would want to take away my freedom of expression are going to recycle. You know, that they care about the trees and the planet. And you know what I'm saying? Like even the oppressors now are environmentalists. So it's like, you know, we should all just at least see the little bit of hope in that. At least I was trying to. And finally, the next day, I was speaking at a thing in New Jersey, and I said, look, I don't think my book's going to come out, so I thought I'd read a chapter of it to you, and there's a librarian in the audience. She hears this, that the book is going to be banned, and she gets on the internet in all these librarian chat rooms, and they start talking. there, man, I'll tell you, librarians, they're one pissed off group. I mean, talk about, because when you stop and think about it, right, they've had their budget slashed, libraries closed, they're only open for 4 hours, they're not paid anything, the covers are falling off the books because they're 30 years old, right? So they are like, you know, you may think they're quiet, they're just sitting there very quiet, but they're not quiet, they're plotting, you know? And they started inundating HarperCollins with all these letters. You shall not ban this book. We will protest, you know? And these, I didn't even know who these people were. And suddenly HarperCollins, I get a call. May we see you in our office? And so I go over there, and we have this one last meeting where they try to pound me down one more time. And now they've flown in the some, I don't know, vice president of the News Corp. News Corp owns HarperCollins. Rupert Murdoch owns News Corp. Now, you see, the Catholic in me is saying at this time, go to bed with the devil, here's your punishment. Mike, you are deserving every single minute of this torture because you chose to go and have your book published by Rupert Murdoch. So, so we have this one last blowout. I just tell them I don't care. Because, see, that's always been my attitude anyways. I never have cared. I don't care. I care by not caring. You know what I'm saying? It's like, because then they'll never have you then. If they ever think that anything they dangle in front of your nose, you know, that you actually want that, then they've got you. But if you don't care, and you really don't care, then there's no way they can ever own you. So I said, nope, that's it. They blinked, and 3 days later, they said, we're putting the book out uncensored, untouched, just the way you wrote it, and good luck because it's not going to sell, because you are completely out of touch with the times in the country, 90% approval rating, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so they said, we're going to send you to 3 or 4 cities. Ridgewood, New Jersey. That was my first stop on Saturday. Arlington, Virginia. See, they think they're screwing me by not sending me to DuPont Circle, you know, because it's they who have misread the country. I'm glad to be in Arlington, Virginia, right? Because I believe that the American people, when it's all said and done, forget about the politics of it, liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican, whatever, at the core of most of the people in this country is a good heart. Most people believe in a sense of fair play. Most people have a good common sense mechanism that tells them right from wrong. And if you can clearly explain what's going on and point out what's happening, I think that people will respond in a very positive way. And I have not believed these approval ratings from day one. I think that, look, a stranger calls you in the middle of the night. You're living in the middle of Kansas, right? 9 o'clock at night, some stranger calls up. I'm a pollster. You know, during the times that we're in right now, right? You know, you're living there in Kansas. You're looking, you know, you're seeing men in black, you know, taking people away. The civil liberties are being stripped from people. The Constitution is being shredded. And I'm a pollster, and I would like to know one thing. Do you approve of the President of the United States? I mean, really, what are you going to answer? I mean, who? You know what I'm saying? Yes, I approve! I approve! My wife approves! The dog approves! Leave me alone! Don't take me away! Right now, we have X number of citizens. We don't know their names. We don't know how many there are. And we don't know where they've taken them in the United States of America. I'm going to say it again. We don't know their names. Nobody knows their names. Nobody knows where they've been taken. And we don't know how many of them they are. Are we asking our kids to go to Afghanistan to risk their lives, to possibly die for that? To take away the very freedoms that we have, the things that people have fought and died for in this country, that somehow then the way that we're going to get the enemy is to make ourselves less free, to take away our civil liberties, to do this thing that, you know, the book has been out for 1 week. It came out a week ago today. This morning it entered its 9th printing. Book in 1 week has already sold more copies then downsized this, my last book did, in a year, and that was a bestseller. In 1 week, it sold more than that book did in a year.
Wow.
That's how fast this thing is. They can't print, and they have to go to the printing press twice a day now because the demand is so huge. Now, I'm telling you this not because I think it's a big-ass deal that I'm on a bestseller list or, oh, I'm number one! I'm telling you that that 80% approval rating is not correct, and that the American public does not like a lot of what it sees going on. And if you ask them how they felt about the issues, you know, instead of the person, look, most people, when they feel that we're in harm's way or our lives are in peril or there's some risk involved, are going to get behind the leader, whoever the leader is. It's just human nature to do that. Love the one you're with. You know, this is what we're stuck, you know, we're stuck with this guy. That's what we got. And that's where that sentiment is coming from. It's coming from actually that place in that good heart that most Americans have. It's not a bad thing, and it's been completely misread. And I think that people are very anxious to have some questions being asked. We've had 5.5 months of being silent. Let's get behind. Let's not criticize. United we stand, et cetera, et cetera. And I got a feeling Bush could have kept that going longer had he not abused the trust that the good-hearted people gave him. But when they see him trying to get through tax bills that are meant to only benefit the wealthy few, under the cover of 9/11, people are offended by that. September 11th, my wife and I, we were out in L.A. We were out there for the Emmy Awards because our show, The Awful Truth, was up this year for another Emmy. And so we were there, and her mother calls 6:15 in the morning. New York's under attack, and we live on the island of Manhattan. And our daughter is back there. And we turn on the TV and we see what's going on. And we're stuck out there 3,000 miles away. We're watching this, and we're trying to call our daughter. You can't get through on any lines. We're trying to call our friend Joanne, who lives just a couple blocks, works a couple blocks in the World Trade Center. Can't get her on the line. We're calling. We're just, you know, beside ourselves. A few minutes before 10 o'clock, I got through to Joanne's office, and the woman picks up the phone. She's screaming. I said, "Is Joanne there? Is she okay?" I don't know. And then she's, I gotta go. And I'm hearing what sounds like actually a train up there on the 17th floor of this building. And what I'm hearing is the roar, the rumble and the roar of the first tower coming down. I'm hearing it, you know, live over the telephone, you know. And my wife says, "Look at the TV." And there it goes. And she drops the phone. And then we don't know for the next 6 or 7 hours if they are okay, if Joanne's okay. We still can't get a hold of our daughter. 4 hours later, we got a hold of her. And then we started to try and figure out how to get out of Los Angeles, how to get out. You know, the airplanes, planes are shut down, no, can't get out. Trains, forget it. Okay, let's try and rent a car. Rental cars are all gone. Keep trying to rent a car. A couple days, finally we got a rental car and we got in there and bolted across the country and drove the 3,000 miles to get back. And we're watching the TV that first night. They started to run some of the names on the ticker where they tell us how the stock market is doing, was replaced with the names of the dead, on starting with the planes, the people on the planes, some of the names. And one of the names that runs across is this name, William Weems. And I'm thinking, no, this can't be true. And so it turns out that this individual, whose name we saw, of course, was one of our line producers, who lives in Boston, was on the Boston plane that went into the second tower. So when I hear George W. Bush use September 11th as the reason to essentially stick it to the American people, when I hear the Boeing aircraft company say that due to September 11th, we're laying off 10,000 people, you know, I mean, how many times have we heard this, due to September 11th? It's so disgraceful. It so dishonors the dead who died here just down the street, who died in New York City, who died in that field in Pennsylvania. To use these people in that event, you know, people started. I got two faxes from fans who faxed these things to me. You know, company memos. I love these company memos. You know, the inner office memos. You know, and due to September 11th, there will be no office Christmas party this year. I got an email of another inner office memorandum. Due to 9/11, the Mr. Coffee has been removed from the employee line. I mean, I'm not making this up. I mean, this is like, have these people no shame? They are hoping that the grief that we all collectively feel, the anger that most people collectively feel, will sustain itself so that our eyes will remain on that, on the enemy, and not on where the real problem is. So I would like to ask George W. Bush a number of questions. And I'm writing these up, and I'm going to put them on my website, but I want to tell you a few of them now, because I think we have a right to know some of these things as Americans and as citizens of this country. Number one, why is it that the Bin Laden family were one of your main financial backers of your first oil venture in Texas back in the 80s, a venture called Arbusto, financed with Bin Laden family money? Why was it on September 12th and 13th, the only plane that was allowed in the skies over America was a private Saudi jet that went to four or five American cities and picked up to 20 members of the Bin Laden family and scooted them out of the country over the objections of the FBI, who usually like to interrogate family members in a murder case? They wanted to ask a few questions of the relatives of the murderer that they couldn't find. And the Bush administration said, no, you will not ask them any questions. And they were taken out of the country. Don't take my word for this. I'm going to quote, and you can go to my website. This is all in very mainstream sources, publications. That piece of information is in an article by Jane Mayer in the November 12th New Yorker magazine. I'd like to know why it is that when George Sr., for the last 10 years, when he visits Saudi Arabia, stays at the Bin Laden Palace. And what are the Bin Laden financial connections to the Carlyle Group that Bush and Baker have formed? Are you aware of this? Have you heard any of this stuff? Do you know this about the... I mean, this all in like the Washington Post, the New York Times, it's all there. Trust me, I've done no work. I mean, literally, I've always been one of those people that read the headline and like the first five paragraphs, because it always says, turn to page 23. And for me, like, that's just too much work. You know, that's too much aerobics. That's just, plus I've never figured out how to read the paper. Are you supposed to read the first five paragraphs of every article and then go read them in order that you read them in? Or are you supposed to read the one, go to the 23, when I'm all done at the end of 23, go back to the front page and start again? That never feels right, does it? You've left the front page. I don't know, it's just me. I just have never figured out how to read the paper. But lately, I've started to go to that jump page. So on the jump page, is what they call it, the jump page, in paragraph 52 or whatever, this Washington Post article a few days after September 11th, it says in this paragraph, buried in the story, that Osama bin Laden is on dialysis. Oh, wait a minute. He's on dialysis. They said that his kidneys, his failing kidneys, and it's been this way for about 18 months. You're telling me that he's, like, going from cave to cave in Afghanistan? Hooked up to a dialysis machine? Or is it like a dialysis machine in every third cave? Or this is a country that has 20 miles of railroad in the entire country. All right? What, am I stupid or what? I mean, what is this? You know? But you see, and you never read about it again after that. I mean, it came out a little bit after the December, you know, funniest home video that Bin Laden, you know, sent over. You know, the one where he was all, remember the skin was green and he was all gaunt. Remember that one? You know, any nurses or doctors present? Failing kidneys, you know, green skin. It's like then I noticed a few people started bringing it up again. That the guy's got a kidney problem. This is a guy that can't. Not only doesn't have a pot to piss in, he can't piss in the pot. And yet, he's supposed to be the mastermind of all evil. He's behind all of this, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, this one man, Osama, if you're watching the Fox News Channel. Osama bin Laden is your man. And Bush goes on TV, we're going to smoke him out. We're going to smoke him out, and we're going to kill him. That's our mission. We're going to kill Osama bin Laden. We're going to kill him. I mean, it's like, can you imagine Franklin Delano Roosevelt 50, 60 years ago standing in a... Our mission is, we're going to kill Hitler. We're going to don't kill Hitler. Okay, everybody, let's go. Let's go kill Hitler. Why? It's just like the world's a little more complex than that, you know? And then they couldn't kill him. They couldn't kill Bin Laden because they couldn't find him. You know, as Ralph says, they went over to burn down a haystack to find the needle. And then they couldn't find the needle. Well, that's okay. That really wasn't our mission anyways. We have a new mission now. You know, it's the war. It's the war on terrorism. Because terrorism is everywhere. And the terrorists are everywhere. They could be in this room right now. You know, we must be on alert. This is a special alert. We're not going to tell you why. We just want you to be on alert. the list of things that, I don't know if you've flown lately, that you can't take through with you onto the airplane, the toenail clippers, the needle and thread, you know, what's the weirdest thing? I can't even remember some of them. They're just so... Tweezers, knitting needles, yeah, you name it. You can't bring it on, right? Well, on the original list that the FAA gave to the Bush administration of things they wanted banned, especially after Richard Reed, the guy, you know, lit his shoes on fire, or tried to light his shoes on fire, which, frankly, I haven't seen since I'm at a Motley Crue concert in the late 80s. Some guy threw up or something. And just light him. I don't know what was going on, but I never, that's the last time I saw a guy light his shoes on fire. But this guy looked like he was really going to light his shoes on fire and blow up this plane. And so the FAA suggested maybe we shouldn't allow butane lighters on the planes. Because if the butane in there, you could start a little fire with that, right? Makes kind of common sense, right? Right? That item gets removed from the list. Now, why is the item removed from the list? Because the tobacco companies have lobbied the Bush administration to take the Bic lighter off the list. And they said, whatever it is you want, Mr. Tobacco, you get. Because you are more important than the safety of the American people. Of course, they don't put it in words like that. You know, because they got to keep, out of the other side of their mouth, they got to keep telling us that they're keeping us safe for the terrorists. But you see, that's not really what any of this is about. What this is about is an oil, a pipeline, that Unocal has been wanting to build for years. Information comes out about this, about Halliburton's involvement in this, about Enron's involvement in this, about how the Taliban visited Texas. Don't take my word for this. Go to the BBC website, BBC, you know, fairly mainstream, sedate news gathering organization. Go to their website. 1995 story, the BBC. The oil executives who hosted the Taliban representatives in Houston, they came there to start these discussions to get this the pipeline that the oil guys wanted to build. I'm not drawing any final conclusions to any of this because I honestly don't know half of what's going on. I don't even know, you know, 90% of what's going on. Most of us don't. But I think these questions have to be asked. I want to know why this is. I want to know what the money, I want to know where the money trail is. I want to know what the connections are with the Bush family. I want to know, I want you to explain to me one more time why it's just a coincidence that the son of this family is doing this against this oil family in this country and his son, and he's the president, and he's the terrorist, and somehow we're all caught in the middle, and average Americans die as a result of this. I want to know really what's going on here, and I would like to see just one person in the media, especially in this town, ask these questions that I've asked here right now. What are the connections? Why did that plane, why was that plane allowed to leave without the FBI interrogating any of the family members? Why, now, and I, you know, I brought this up to Bill Maher on Politically Incorrect, and he goes, well, Mike, you know, you can't, like, just paint with a broad brush every member of the Bin Laden family just because of one bad Bin Laden. And I said, no, you're absolutely right. I'm sure most of the family, they're good and decent people. But do you think that there would be pictures of the president or the president's dad and former president having a sleepover with Manson's parents? You think we'd ever see a picture of that? You know, even I'm sure Manson's parents are good people too. You know, they probably wouldn't do that. Wouldn't look good, right? Wouldn't look good. But when George Sr. goes to Saudi Arabia, that's where he has a sleepover at the Bin Laden Palace. And there's lots of photos of them, you know, shaking hands and doing the thing they do. I don't even kind of want to even go here because I just got a feeling that in this can of worms at the bottom of it is something we don't even really want to know, that we don't really want to think about just how terrible and how awful this is. And I'm not, you know, claiming some kind of conspiracy or this, that, or whatever. You know, at the very least, I would just like the Republicans in this town to answer to the American people one thing. To one question. Do you think that the 200 FBI agents that you had wasting their time investigating a stain on a blue dress for the last years of the 90s, all that time, all that money, all that energy, 200 FBI agents assigned to that case, do you think had those 200 FBI agents been doing their real job of protecting the American public, of finding out who might be taking classes at flight schools and not wanting to learn how to land or take off? You know, do you think possibly if 200 more people have been devoted to that, we wouldn't know people who died on September 11th? I want somebody to ask that question. Our time with that. And I tell you, I don't even want to, I won't and don't want to support wasting the country's time impeaching George W. Bush. He should be so ashamed of the fact that this administration bought and paid for by Enron. An Enron lawyer is now the White House counsel. An Enron vice president is the Secretary of the Army. The Enron guy, you know, when I started writing this book, I got in this book here, you know, I mentioned Ken Lay, Enron, Arthur Anderson. I wrote this last May. You know, because I saw this little article, you know, it said this guy Ken Lay was stopping by the White House all the time. I'm going, that's an interesting last name, you know. You know, it's like one of those made-up names, you know. It's like, maybe it's the name a lot of guys would like to have. I don't know, but it's like this, hi, I'm Ken Lay. Like some, you know, something you'd see on Cinemax late at night, you know. It's like, and I'm Bill Studd. You know, what is this, Ken Lay? So I started doing a little more digging, and it turns out, oh, he's Kenny Boy. He's a good friend of Bush. And he's provided his Enron jet to Bush and his family to fly around during the primaries in 2000. And during the primaries, Bush actually interrupted the campaigning to go for the opening of Enron Field in Houston, where the Astros play, not so Bush could throw out the first pitch as governor, but so just so he could be there to watch his friend Kenny Boy throw out the first pitch. Which again, you know, see how guys, men have started to, like, care about each other? Yeah, see? It's a good thing, right? It's a silver lining. He flew all that way just to watch Kenny Boy throw out a pitch, a ball. You know, I would be so ashamed and embarrassed. In fact, I have sent a letter to Bush asking that he just simply please resign.
Yes.
And just take Cheney with you. Now, I've asked that he actually do it on the opening day of baseball season. In the middle of Enron Field. I promised him I would be there. The game is between the Astros and the Brewers. It starts at 4:05 p.m. And, you know, you could do like one of those Lou Gehrig things, you know, with the microphone, with the hand over the heart, and, you know, apologize to the American people for this whole calamity and all the people who have lost their jobs and their investment and their retirement and everything. You know, and then we can all sing Da Do Enron Ron, Da Do Enron, and, you know, it could be a great day. And plus, it's baseball. You know, he could throw the first pitch, exactly. You know, we even let him do that. But he said, how can he resign? He's not president. No, he's in the book, I have a chapter called A Very American Coup. And I talk about what happened down in Florida from my perspective and the investigations that were done that didn't get a lot of attention in terms of how African-American voters were blocked from voting and how Catherine Harris, a year before the election, hired a private company to go through the voting rolls to pick out any African-American names that they could legally, hopefully, pull off, like because a convicted felon can't vote in most states. So they got the convicted felon list, went through it, got them all off. Then they asked George in Texas to send a list of Texan felons who might have moved to Florida, took them off. Then they were told, if you've got a name on the voting rolls in these precincts where it sounds like the name of the guy sounds like it's a felon, in other words, on the felon list, there's a felon named Henry Johnson. So if you, on your voting rolls it says Henry Johnston, pull Johnston off. And if Johnston is legit and not a felon, he has the right to protest it and have his thing reinstated either at the polls or later on. That was the orders that this private firm was given. So thousands of African Americans were pulled off. Well, it turns out the list from Texas wasn't even felons. These were people who committed misdemeanors, littering, driving offenses, yanked from the voter rolls in Florida to reduce the number of votes that could go to Gore. Al Gore is the president of the United States, folks. Al Gore won the election. Now, and I say this, I didn't vote for Al Gore, all right? So I should have a certain amount of credibility with this statement, because it's not a partisan statement. You know, Gore, I don't get him. I don't get it. I was like, you know, the guy couldn't win his own state. He wouldn't let Clinton campaign in Arkansas for him. He couldn't get Byrd in West Virginia to endorse him until 5 days before the election, and thus costing, you know, West Virginia 3 electoral votes. Could have put it to bed right there with West Virginia. Couldn't do any of that. And the worst of all, he couldn't wipe the floor with the dumbest man ever to run for president in 3 debates. 3 debates! Was anybody just watching those? Did you just sit there going, oh, what is this guy? Yeah, luck bucks. Or, oh, you know. It's like, I counted, in the second debate, he agreed with Bush 39 times on the issues. I mean, it's like, unbelievable. I couldn't believe it. So, but be that as it may, he got the most votes in the country, or what we call popular votes. We're the only nation, only Democratic nation in the world that has to put an adjective before the word vote. The primal basic word of a democracy, vote. We have to put an adjective, the popular vote. He won that, and he won the votes in Florida, too. Well, the Republicans will say, well, Mike, actually, Gore just wanted to count those 4 counties. If he counted just those 4 counties, he would have lost. No, yeah, that's right. But you see, you know what? Gore doesn't get to decide. It's not up to Gore. If he's so stupid he only wants 4 counties counted, that is not my problem. I'm an American citizen, and that means one person, one vote, every vote's counted. The whole state should have been counted. It's not up to Gore to decide. I shouldn't yak on so long. You've been standing here long enough. But I would love to take a few questions and then sign some books. Yes, sir, over here in the coat and tie.
September the 5th.
I'll repeat the question so you can hear it. I don't know. The question is, on September 5th?
Whatever that third day was.
15, how many billion?
15 billion. It was 5th or the 6th.
15, on the 5th or 6th. 15.
They cleared on September.
On United Airlines stock was United and American was sold. Well, again, this is one of the questions. This is one of the 10 questions that has to be asked. Who made money off this? Who knew it was going to happen? Who made money off it? Who made money off it afterwards? I don't know. I don't know. But there's more to this than meets the eye. You know, they should have picked a much better villain than a guy hooked up to a kidney machine, because he lost me right there. All right? I'm not that stupid. You know, it ain't him. All right? He might be a pretty bad guy, and he might have done some pretty bad stuff. But then again, if he did some bad stuff, like blow up the coal or our African embassies, then why did the Bush administration, in May of last year, give $43 million of our tax money to Taliban Afghanistan? You know, well, the Republicans say, oh, Mike, it was humanitarian aid. Oh, really? Are you that stupid? You would give our tax money to these people? Are these people humanitarians? What do you think they're going to do with our money? Are you nuts? How many Americans know this, that we were funding the Taliban as late as last May? Look it up. May 22nd, LA Times, Toronto Globe and Mail. It's in a lot of papers on the web. You can look it up. Don't believe me. Why was Halliburton meeting with the Taliban this past summer? What's going on? I don't know. But aren't these legitimate questions to ask? Can we now ask them and still be united we stand as Americans who love our country? Can't we ask these questions? Somebody's got to ask these questions. Where is the media?
War on America. Boom, 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 boom. We'll be right back with Geraldo at war. Boom, boom,
You see, the thing that freaked me out about why they wouldn't publish my book when they already had 50,000 pre-orders, which is a boatload of money for them, right? The thing that's always got me out here to you, you know, my movies or the books or the TV show, is this incredible flaw of capitalism, which says that the capitalist will sell you the rope to hang himself with if he can make a buck off it. And because of their desire for the bottom line, they would turn their head to the politics. So TV Nation got on the air on the General Electric Network, or Roger Me was distributed by Time Warner, you know, or The Awful Truth was on Bravo, owned 25% of it owned by GE, or this book by Murdoch. You know, because they're not like us, you see. We have feelings, politics, you know. They just have the bottom line. As long as I make them money, and I've made them millions of dollars from these various ventures. So I'm in a race with them, you see. This is what they believe. They believe that it's safe to put this stuff out to you. Because they're so convinced they've done such a great job of dumbing you down and numbing your minds and making sure you don't turn to the jump page to find out the truth. They're so convinced of that they know it's safe to put Mike and his jokes up on the screen and his book out there to you because they know you will go home and do nothing. I believe the opposite. I believe that there are millions of people who are just dying to do something. Yes. I think they've read it wrong. I got cursed when I was a teenager with this lesson because if you knew me personally, I am a total slack. The nuns are laughing. I am a lazy, I'm a real slacker. If I could watch 5 hours of TV a day, I would do that, you know. I'd have the game channel on all the time. That is my nirvana, you know. And it just, when I was 16 years old and I was sent to this thing called Boy State. Did you have that in your, you know, Boy State and Girl State? Where they send like 10 kids from the high school to go play government in the state capitol for a week in the summer. You run for governor, you run for lieutenant governor, you have campaigns, you know. And so I got selected to go to this. Okay, I'll go. I went down to Michigan State in Lansing, and I'm like, oh man, this is such a drag. You know, because all those people want to run for student council, right? You know those people? They always want to be class, you know the Reese Witherspoon character in Election, that movie, you know? They're the people that we didn't give enough swirlies to in high school, and they go on to become our congressmen years later. If only we had given them more swirlies, they wouldn't be like this, you know? So I'm down there. I'm just sitting in the dorm room. You listen to records, you know. I don't want to go. I don't participate in anything. I'm sitting there. Got the munchies one day. I'm going, okay, where's the vending machine? And I wanted to get some of those Ruffles. They were new then. You know, this is like in the 70s. You know? They had ridges in the potato chips. I thought it was kind of cool. Made me think I was getting more potato chip. And so I go down to this vending machine, and on the bulletin board by the vending machine, it says, speech contest on the life of Abraham Lincoln. Sponsored by the Elks Club. And I'm going, oh, that's interesting, because my dad had just gone to join the Elks Club. But on the bottom of the application, it said, now, this is 1970, 71, okay? On the bottom of the application, it said, Caucasians only. 1970, 71, okay? That's all that was, okay? And he turned around and he left. He wouldn't join. So I knew this. I'm thinking, now this is very interesting. They're here at Boys State sponsoring a speech contest on the life of the great emancipator, and they're just a bunch of racists, right? I'm going to write a speech. So I get the potato chips, I go back to my room, I'm going to enter this contest. So I write the speech up. I give it the next day. Well, the Elks Club aren't there to judge it. They've hired speech teachers from Lansing to judge the speech contest. So I give the speech just railing against them and, you know, yeah, the other, how dare they, you know, besmirch Abraham Lincoln, blah, 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 blah. I win the contest, all right? So I'm going, whoa. And you got to give the speech to all the 3,000 Boy Staters. So I give the speech. And there's the Elks guy there to give me the award, right? And so I say, I don't want the award. And there's a reporter there, and he comes up to me, and he does this little interview with me. 2 hours later, I get a call from the CBS Evening News in New York, with Walter Cronkite, I'm a producer there. Would you come on the CBS Evening News tonight? I'm like 16 years old. I'm like, oh, man. you know, it's like, no, I'm just like, oh, I'm not like a really political, you know, political. I mean, I'm not one of those, you know, I mean, I care about what's going on, but I'm like, I'm not, you know, and I, you know, like no amount of Clearasil could have helped me at that point. You know, and I'm just like, oh, geez. Okay. So I go on the CBS Evening News. Well, as soon as that aired on CBS, congressional investigations about these private organizations and clubs that are discriminatory, that are segregated, laws get passed, the whole thing, and in 6 months, the Elks Club and all those other clubs have to integrate. And I'm thinking, all this just because I wanted a bag of Ruffles. That's all it was. I mean, it was really... At an early age, I learned that to affect change, you actually don't have to do a whole lot. I mean, it's like you think you do. That's why a lot of people stay away from politics. You know, they see the kids at the Greenpeace table on the campus, you know, on the cardboard table, and they're out there 24 hours a day. I could never do that. You know? And no, of course you couldn't. Those are only for saints. Those are good. They have a special place in heaven. That's why they're there. You know? But the rest of you don't have to do that. You just have to do a little bit. You just have to, like, vote. You know? You just have to turn to the jump page. You just have to broaden your mind a little bit. You just have to talk to the person at work who works next to you about, man, what's that with the Saudi plane picking up the bin Ladens on September 12th? That blows my mind. What's that about? You don't sit on the sidelines and watch it happen. If everybody sat out, it wouldn't be a democracy. It'd be something else. So just, if you claim to be an American, you are an activist. You have to be an activist. So I tell you that story about the potato chips at 16 because I'm just telling you that you don't have to do a lot to make things happen in this world. And just look at just the people in this room tonight. If you just thought about what you could do, you know, tomorrow, whether it's call a congressman and say, I want these questions answered, or call the editor at your local paper. You know, you should think about running for office yourself. Why do we always leave it to the bozos to do this? Some of you in this room should be running. Does it seem that our response was a little too rapid for September 11th? I mean, with the Gulf War, where it took us 6 or 7 months before we could actually mobilize, and they were already holding exercises over there. They already had the plans, you know, laid out for if they ever needed to do this someday. What's interesting is watching the Fox News channel that morning at 9:15, they called it for Osama bin Laden. They said, we have on good source that Osama bin Laden is behind this. This is before the plane hit the Pentagon. This is before the towers came down. Fox News Channel was already saying Osama bin Laden. And it's chilling when you go back and watch it now. It's really...
What about Iraq?
Well, Iraq, the axis of evil exists because this one was over too fast. You know. The Taliban got some razors, you know. Shaved off the beards. Okay, no more Taliban. You know, these Americans are easy to fool. And so Taliban gone. You guys can go down. And this thing was over much faster than they needed it to be. So they had to come up with something much larger. So war on terrorism. Terrorism is everywhere. North Korea, Iraq. You know, get ready for the next hoo-ha. Because the Enron thing is so deep. And so damaging to his survival as an occupier of the Oval Office, that they're going to need the mother of all distractions. The new movie, I'm finishing it right now. It's a documentary feature that'll be in theaters hopefully by the end of the year. It's called Bowling for Columbine. And it is a look at the American culture of violence and why we are the unique country that has this pathology in terms of why we choose to kill our own with guns and other countries don't, and specifically Canada, which there's 10 million households in Canada. They've got 7 million guns. There's more hunters in Canada than there are hockey players, all right? They've got all these guns laying around, and they have about 150 murders a year. That's all. They don't, even though they got the guns laying around. So basically, this film takes a look also at the liberal belief that if only we had gun control, we'd be living in a safer society. What I'm saying is that I don't think that's really the issue, folks. And I think that we've got a much larger problem here. And it has to do with guns. It has to do with our foreign policy. It has to do with the way we act in our daily lives. And it's a very provocative film. I hope you get to get to see it when it comes out. Yes. How do you get this across? How do you tell your local media or that you want this stuff covered? I got to tell you, you know, this is something I learned when we had TV Nation on NBC. They told me that NBC, if they got more than five calls at NBC after any show, they considered that an enormous response. If they got 20 calls, there was a meeting the next morning. 20 calls nationwide, you know. Yes. What should D.C. do to get congressional representation? Massive nonviolent civil disobedience.
Yes.
I'm serious. You will not get the attention of anybody, I think, without it. It's just not. It's not on the radar, and it's a disgrace. And I'm telling you, when anthropologists dig up our country 400 or 500 years from now, they are not going to understand why the people in the very capital of the country, the entire free world, does not give full rights of citizenship and voting power to those very people. And it will make no sense, seriously, to an anthropologist. Now, we will have to leave a note behind, a videotape, or some explaining our actions. So listen, I'm going to, we'll try and sign as many of these books as possible. Thank you for coming. Go out and do something, okay, for your support.
That was filmmaker and author Michael Moore speaking recently in Arlington, Virginia. Thanks to the D.C. Independent Media Center for that tape. If you'd like to hear Michael Moore in person, he will be speaking in Ithaca at Cornell University on April 3rd at 7:30 p.m. at Statler Auditorium. Admission is free and tickets can be obtained from Willard Strait Hall box office starting on March 25th. You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. Before we turn our focus to opinion management in public broadcasting, there are several upcoming events here in the Finger Lakes that you might be interested in. The first, a screening of two films at Hobart William Smith College. They are The Bombing and Women of Hezbollah. They will be shown at 7 p.m. on Tuesday, March 26th, in the Geneva Room of the Warren Hunting Smith Library on the campus of Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva. Professor Dan McGowan will introduce the films and lead a post-screening discussion. The event is free and the public is welcome. Also on Tuesday, March 26th, Pedro Zenon, son of imprisoned Vieques fisherman Carlos Zenon, will be speaking at GIAC in Ithaca at Court and Albany Streets at 6 p.m. and will also be speaking the following day, Wednesday, March 27th at 6 p.m. at Cornell University in the Goldwin Smith Lecture Hall D. Both events are followed with food prepared by La Cucina Latina Catering. For more info, contact Mary Ann Grady Flores of the Ithaca Catholic Worker Vieques Support Group at area code 607-273-7437. Last but very far from least, Ithaca Community Radio is pleased to announce the long-awaited return of the Bread and Puppet Theater to historic Ithaca's State Theater. The seven Bread and Puppet performers will arrive in Ithaca, third stop on its Northeast Spring Tour next week, to rehearse with 30 volunteer performers for a Maundy Thursday Passover Storm Moon performance of The Insurrection Mass with Funeral March for a Rotten Idea in 10 Movements, a non-religious service in the presence of papier-mâché gods. Bread and Puppet Theater will perform Thursday, March 28th at 8 p.m. at the State Theater. Tickets are $10 and will benefit the Ithaca Community Radio Project. They're available at Green Star Co-op, Autumn Leaves Used Books on the Ithaca Commons, Sea Spot Gallery, and the Ticket Center at Clinton House. Area code 607-273-4497, and tickets will of course be available at the door. Tickets will be discounted for seniors 60 and over, and also for those 12 and under, though parental discretion is advised due to the difficult subject matter. David Bar-Simeon is best known to listeners as the producer and host of Alternative Radio, a syndicated program that airs weekly on this station. He's also the author of several books. His most recent is The Decline and Fall of Public Broadcasting. He spoke on that subject last month in Santa Cruz, California.